Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, the Markela Center for Applied Ethics, and the Ignatian Center for Jesuit Education at Santa Clara University. My name is David DeCosse. I'm the Director of Campus Ethics Programs at the Markela Center for Applied Ethics. It is my pleasure to introduce Sister Carol Keehan, President and CEO of the Catholic Health Association of the United States. Sister Keehan is a Daughter of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul, an order of nuns within the Catholic Church founded in 1633 and dedicated to providing to the poor the corporal and spiritual works of mercy. She began her career as a nurse and later obtained a doctoral degree. Sister Keehan's administrative record amid the challenges and complexities of contemporary healthcare is remarkable. She has worked in administrative positions at hospitals sponsored by the Daughters of Charity for more than 35 years. Since 2005, she has been the Chief Executive Officer of the Catholic Health Association. In that role, she is responsible for the management of more than 600 hospitals, nursing homes, and clinics. That translates roughly into 15% of the hospital beds in the United States. Her accomplishments have also been widely recognized. Pope Benedict XVI awarded her the honor known as the Cross for the Church and the Pontiff. Sister Keehan was named in 2010 one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World. Her support of the Affordable Care Act in the spring of 2010 was considered essential for the passage of federal health care reform. Her concerns raised in the last months about the contraception regulation issued by the Health and Human Services Department have garnered the close attention of both the White House and the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Wherever one falls on the issues of health care reform and related matters, we can be sure of several things. The delivery of health care in this country is in a period of great change, and amid that great change are crucial questions of value, of great importance to Catholics and to many other Americans. We are very grateful to Sister Carol for being with us this evening to help us think through these challenging matters. Sister Carol.
David, thank you for that very kind introduction. Let me make it really clear as we start off. David mentioned Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World. That sounds quite classy. Let me just be clear on this. In that 100 Most Influential People were myself, Lady Gaga, three or four dictators. It is not the communion of saints, so don't take it too seriously. It is a great honor to be here, to be invited to this great university, to this program sponsored by the Commonwealth Club and the universities, and to have the opportunity to talk with you about Catholic healthcare and healthcare in general for this nation. It is a critical topic. And so I'm honored to be with you, and I'm open to any questions, comments, suggestions, criticisms that you have. So I thought I would walk quickly with you through a little bit about Catholic healthcare, about healthcare in general, the mandates and morals in an era of change. Let's just look quickly at where Catholic hospitals are. As you can see, there are a lot of Catholic hospitals in this country. Then you add the continuing care, the nursing homes, the clinics, the surgery centers. We have a lot of presence in Catholic healthcare. Catholic healthcare for this nation is a great gift. And it is a great gift that has given from the earliest times of our country. And it is a great gift that we must preserve and enhance for the future of this country. You look at the number of facilities we have, and one way to look at the acute care presence of Catholic health care is that one out of every six people in this country who goes into a hospital for care goes into a Catholic hospital. That's a significant contribution to the care of the health of this nation. If you look at the number of people who are employed in Catholic healthcare, the number of physicians, the number of collaborations that go on with community health organizations, the partnerships that exist in every community to try to make healthier communities, to try to deal with to help the most vulnerable among us get the care they need, not just the care they can afford. Look at that number of emergency room visits. Look at that number of outpatient visits. And we do have a focus on the poor and populations with special needs. And so you will find in Catholic healthcare, far more often than in any other kind of healthcare, whether it's sponsored by the community or sponsored by the government, sponsored by for-profits, sponsored by a university, you will find far more often programs in hospitals that are there because the community needs them and not because they are programs that make money or support themselves. Psychiatry, drug treatment, neonatal intensive care, burn units, those kinds of programs that Catholic healthcare says the community needs this, we have to find a way to have it there. In some states, we are a huge percentage of the total healthcare in that state. And in others, we're a much smaller percentage. And so you look at this great treasure for the nation that we all love. And you say, well, what's the future? We're in a really challenging new time. And so we've got the Affordable Care Act. We've got the election. And the one thing you wouldn't want to be right now is a hospital CEO. Because we've got one person running to be reelected who wants to roll out the Affordable Care Act and one person running to be elected who wants to kill it. And you say, well, now be prepared. Well, what would I be prepared for, dear? And so, you know, it's a very challenging time. We've got the economics. I mean, we are living in a time of where we are hopefully emerging from the most severe recession since the Great Depression. And we are doing that at a time when the economics of many of the strongest superpowers of the world, the economic superpowers of the world, are in what is now a global economy, are really very fragile. Whether it's the European Union or Japan or many other nations, we are living in a very challenging economic time. In case you haven't noticed, we're living in a time when there are a lot of concerns in the church. The church can appear to many of us to be very polarized. Can appear to have really strong opinions on one side or the other and not a lot of tolerance for discussion about middle ground. It's a challenging time when so much of what we do and the decisions we make in Catholic healthcare tend to be guided by church teaching. So you look at what do we do about this and what does this all mean and how do we as people of faith, how do we as people who care about our church, about our nation, how do we go forward? And you look at the historic health reform because that's what's sort of top of the mind that was signed into law in March of 2010. It is every bit as significant as the 1965 signing of the Medicare and Medicaid law. And most of us are pretty used to, come day, go day, Medicare's been here for such a long time. So we think, yeah, okay, you know, we know Medicare. It's been here forever. What would we ever do if we didn't have Medicare? Well, let me be really clear. As somebody who took a lot of heat for the Affordable Care Act, I did a lot of research on the Medicare and Medicaid Act. And let me say, it was every bit as contentious in every realm of our society as the Affordable Care Act was. There was an expectation in January of 1965 that every physician in the United States would go on strike, that no one would be able to get a physician to care for them because the AMA was so adamantly opposed to Medicare. We had the church opposed. The Archbishop of Los Angeles, Cardinal McIntyre, said that we should not even think about this act. The priest should be talking only about spiritual things, nothing else. The Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago said the priest should be concerned if people are hungry, if they can't get health care, if they can't get food, if they can't get housing, and they can't get clothing. They should be concerned about those things. So the church was fighting about it. I've said to many people, I wish this time it was a fight between two cardinals, but it wasn't. but truly, it was a very contentious time. And people talk about the way this bill was passed. It was passed almost exactly the same way in 65. And interestingly, we look at the people like Senator McConnell and Representative Boehner, who were so adamantly opposed to this bill being passed. And you step back and look at Medicare. And the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee at the time this was passed was Wilbur Mills. He was very powerful. And his sole purpose in life, and he made it very clear, was to prevent President Lyndon Johnson from passing the Medicare bill. We're not going to socialize medicine in the United States. This is a disaster. I will never let it happen. Now, the way we got Wilbur Mills diminished his authority was, some of you in this room are old enough to remember, was Wilbur Mills had a little bit of a drinking problem. And one night, the height of all this fight, he got caught swimming in one of the fountains in Washington with Fannie Fox, the stripper. He lost a lot of his credibility and a lot of his ability to fight the president. So sometimes you just have to take your gains where you get them. That's not a commercial for strippers, but it take your gains where you get them. But anyway, it is important for us to look at this so that we don't tend to think all history started with us. Think about today, where would we be without the Medicare program? Where would so many of our elderly be? It is important, and I am someone who spent my whole adult life in healthcare. I lived in hospitals. That's where I lived my whole adult life. I love hospitals. I love the people who work in hospitals. But I have to tell you, the health care system in this country is absolutely unsustainable, it is unfair, and it is inefficient. And that doesn't take away from the fact that if you have access to a particular hospital or doctor or healthcare system, that you couldn't get superb care, the best care in the world. But the system itself, in terms of a system to serve the entire nation, was unsustainable, unfair, and inefficient. So you look at the need. We had approximately 50 million uninsured. The Census Bureau just 2-3 weeks ago did the final census, and it's 48 point some million uninsured. We had millions more underinsured, so that they struggled to maintain a policy only to find out that it covered $750 of chemotherapy. Well, that's not going to get you the first shot. So when they really needed it, they found out it didn't work. And this has real consequences. The Institute of Medicine has documented that in this nation, the richest nation in the world, we have 18,000 preventable deaths every year due to a lack of access to healthcare services. These are people who don't get mammograms, who don't follow up on a little bit of blood in their urine or a little bit of blood in their stool, never get their blood pressure checked or their blood sugar checked. These are the people that when we find how serious their problem is, it is too late to do much more than palliative care for them. You know, those are scientific findings. 18,000 unnecessary deaths a year. We have many instances of people who work with the low-income elderly of them choosing between food and medicine, having a medication they're supposed to take 3 times a day that they take once every other day because they simply can't afford it. We have over 9 million children in this country, 9 million children, uninsured. Now, that means without access to care, except if they get really sick and go to an emergency room. There is not any good excuse for a child not having access to care for their health. There is nothing pro-life about 9 million uninsured children. So you look again at in this country, over 50% of our personal bankruptcies are due to health expenses. Harvard did a study a couple of years ago and showed when you look at cancer survivors, 4 out of every 10 cancer survivors. The good news was they survived the cancer. The bad news was they were bankrupt. That's no way for this nation to treat its people. Our national abortion rate has gone down 8%. Among low-income women, it has gone up 18%. Doesn't take a lot of thinking to realize why these women feel they have no choice. The most vulnerable with serious illnesses lose their coverage when they hit the limit. These are people with the very serious chronic illnesses, or when they have to change insurance and it becomes a pre-existing condition. I need to say to you, as somebody who worked very hard to get this bill crafted and very hard to get it passed, it is not a perfect solution. It is not the bill I would have written. I doubt seriously it's the bill the president would have written or any of the leadership in either house of the Congress would have written. But it is a bill that has great potential to help the American people, especially working families and the poor. A lot of the people who wait on us every day. We have to start the journey to full coverage for all. We have been looking at this and calling for this since before Harry Truman. That's long enough to procrastinate. We see the consequences of this as well as the suffering on a daily basis. We have to start the solution. We can't ignore that suffering and say we got to have a perfect solution. Name the bill that has come out of our Congress in the history of this nation that is perfect. There is none. But we have done great good. Even our Constitution has been amended. CHA had a vision for what we wanted in health reform, and we developed that vision with a lot of consultation with our members, people on the front line of healthcare, some on the front line in caring for patients, clinicians, some on the front line in our admitting office. You know, people who watched what happened when folks couldn't make their copay. And we said very clearly to the members of the House of Representatives, to the Senate, and to the White House, we will compromise on our preferences about this bill, but not our principles. And when the three hospital associations, the American Hospital Association and the For-Profit Hospital Association, CHA, met with any of those groups, the other two associations always made time for me to make that point clear. Even though we've talked about, you know, modify this, fix that, do this, if you do all of those things, but you don't, but you compromise our principles, do not look for CHA's support. The reform legislation passed. It was upheld by the Supreme Court. I tell many people sometimes at CHA, we refer to the Supreme Court Justice John Roberts as St. John Roberts now. It's been voted down 33 times by the United States House of Representatives. So now what? What's it going to mean to the American people and to healthcare providers? What's already working? You know, this is a bill that's going to be rolled out over like a 6-year period. It's got a 10-year window, but it's got a 6-year period for the bulk of what's going to be rolled out. Already, adult children up to 26 can stay on their parents' policies. And for many of you who teach and many of you who are students here, that's been a godsend. And particular for students who graduated and had difficulty getting full-time jobs with insurance and decent benefits. Already, pre-existing conditions in children cannot be denied coverage. And in 2014, pre-existing conditions in adults will not be allowed to be denied coverage. There's no lifetime limit on benefits. Now, those last two things, about a year ago, I was giving a talk on this at another university. And a woman who worked at the university, who's very well educated, had a nice position, you sort of would look at her and say, well, she's got the American dream, good education, good job. And she came up to me afterwards and she said, sister, those two things alone have totally changed life for my family. She said, my husband has MS, multiple sclerosis, and he has it very badly. My daughter has cerebral palsy, and she has it very badly. And she said, we have lived in fear and dread because both of them are going to hit the upper limit of spending and will have nothing. If I try to get another insurance policy to have a restart the limit, their pre-existing conditions will be denied. And so we go without care as much as we can so that we don't hit the limit. And she said, that's particularly true for my daughter because she's got a lifetime in front of her. And this totally changed the entire future for that family and for many, many, many other families, hardworking people. Already the companies have to prove fraud to cancel a policy. They have to allow an appeal before denying a claim. And you say, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know how many of you remember the nurse from California who testified during the effort to get the bill passed. And she had been a nurse in California, and I forget the city. She had Blue Cross. And she'd worked a number of years in this hospital. Good nurse, good employee, came down with breast cancer. And she went to the doctor, started, had surgery, was just starting chemotherapy. And, of course, her focus is, am I going to survive? Da, 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 you know, all the panicky feelings that someone with cancer and coping with chemo and coping with keeping their finances up and all of those things. And suddenly somebody at the insurance company, very clever, said, I notice you take Claritin, and you take it for your rosacea. You know, a little red rash on your face. She said, they said, you didn't tell us you had rosacea. You committed fraud when you got this policy. It is therefore canceled in the middle of chemotherapy. You know, those things happen to real people. That is not worthy of this great nation. And so when I tell you that, it is, you know, a blah, blah, blah line. But you need to look at the person behind that. And they had person after person talk about that. Today, preventive services have to be available without a copay for Medicare patients and private insurance. And maybe $20 wouldn't keep anybody in this room from getting a mammogram or a colonoscopy. The prep will keep you from the colonoscopy, but the $20 might not. But there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people for whom $20 becomes the difference between meals for the kids the 2 days before payday or filling my kid's asthma prescription. And so we put it off. People have to have a free choice of a primary care. You can't say, you've got to have a primary care in our network, and you call and they say, it'll be 15 months before we can have your first appointment. You have to have a free choice of a primary care. There has to be a mandatory benefit package, so you can't find yourself needing treatment for cancer and having $750 of medication coverage or $2,000 of hospital stay coverage. There's a mandatory benefit package. This next one is one I think has got the most potential to lower the cost and to make it more advantageous to be a policyholder in an insurance company rather than a stockholder of that insurance company. Insurance companies have to spend 80 to 85% of the insurance dollars they take in premiums for medical care and quality. And right after the Supreme Court made its decision, a number of insurance companies across this nation had to refund millions of dollars because they had not spent that much, and so they had to give it back to the employer and the employee who had those policies. That will keep insurance companies from just jacking up insurance to whatever the market will bear. There's already a very strong monitoring of rate increases. What's going to work in the future? There's going to be new coverage for the working uninsured, projected to hit 30 to 32 million. So of the 48 million we talked about, 30 to 32 million should get coverage. And they're going to get it in two ways. Medicaid eligibility will increase, and then eligibility will increase and be 100% federally funded so that it's not a cost to the states. It will be federally funded. The Medicaid payment for primary care will increase to the Medicare rate, so physicians will be more interested in the Medicaid patient. The health insurance exchanges, and here I want to pay tribute to California. California has done, I would say, as much and more than most any other state in the union to prepare for accountable care. But the exchanges are going to be available to small businesses so that people, you know, right now when a small business buys insurance for 50 employees, they pay per employee 2, 3, 4 times what a large organization like General Electric, Monsanto, Xerox pays per employee. They are the most profitable line of business for insurance companies, and I've served on 3 Blue Cross boards, so I say that from experience. But 16 million of these people who are in small businesses will qualify for insurance in the exchanges. And they will not only have a lower cost for a really good policy, but the employee, depending on their salary, will get a federal subsidy to help them pay for their portion, and the employer, as an incentive to insure their employees, will get up to 35% of their cost as a tax credit from the United States government. So those combinations should allow about 16 million employees in small businesses, employees and owners of small businesses. And one of the things that's important to recommend, to realize, is that 70% of small businesses in this country are less than 10 employees. So we have to make this simple. And there's a lot of work going on to set up these exchanges in ways that make it easy for people to work. And so people are really trying very hard to have computers where people can go on and pick their, sort of the way you do Travelocity. And we're going to continue to work with every state and all our members to make sure, because when somebody, to many of us, for instance, the president of this university, or me as the president of CHA, when I get something that says, the insurance company says blah, 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 I just say, give it to the HR director. They figure it out and tell me what I need to know. In small businesses, 70% are under 10 employees. So that means the guy changing your oil is the president and CEO and the director of HR. So we need to make it possible for these exchanges to be so simple. And there'll be, for all of us, a lot more quality data available for not only our doctor, but for us. There'll be clinical effectiveness studies, and there'll be much more transparency, so we can make better decisions, as opposed to drug commercials and things like that. What's working right now in California? You've already had over 1.4 million Californians who have Medicare get preventive services without any cost. You've had over 214,000 of them get the closing of that donut hole, and some of you are young enough not to understand the donut hole, but the prescription drug benefit in Medicare is a great thing, but it gets to a certain point, and the sickest elderly who take the most medicine all of a sudden have no coverage until they spend a lot more money and get up to this level, then they get coverage again. And many people call that the donut hole. So we are trying with this bill to close that donut hole over a period of about 3 years. You've got pre-existing condition insurances, and your small businesses are already eligible for a tax credit. Look at what could happen to California. And let me say here that the people who are the economists of healthcare say very clearly that California has the potential to do better under the Affordable Care Act than any other state in the union, because of your population, because of the structure of it, and because of the way you have responded. But if you look at these two maps, you can see that in California right now, you have between 10 and 16% of your children uninsured. I would say probably a lot of those children are immigrants, perhaps undocumented immigrants. If you fully implement this, you could get that down to 7 to 10%. And I would say most of that 7 to 10% will be undocumented. But that's huge progress. For the parents, you could do even better. You could go from 23% down to less than 7% of your parents not being uninsured. That is a huge gain in quality care, in access to care, a huge gain in human dignity, and a huge economic gain for the state. When you look at this from a perspective of Catholic health care, let me say CHA supported the Affordable Care Act. We have asked, as David said, for some modifications in the mandate language. We intend to work vigorously to help people who are eligible for coverage, particularly in 2014 when the Medicaid expansion and the exchanges roll out, to get that. We're going to continue to raise the issue for those not covered by the law, particularly our brothers and sisters who are immigrants. The church's position on health care, our official teaching by all the most recent popes, is health care is a right based on our human dignity. The bishops have pushed for years for universal health care. They opposed the Affordable Care Act, but they have not asked for its overturned. We do have issues. We have abortion. We have euthanasia. We have some stem cell issues, embryonic stem cell issues. In the area of conscience protection, in the mandate where preventive services have to be available for free, this is a wonderful thing. One part of it says we have included in preventive services contraception and sterilization. We have said, you know, that's fine if that's what you want. Now, in California, that's a dead issue. The state of California already mandates that. It was litigated, and Catholic facilities have to provide it. Nationwide, we are very concerned that that mandate exempt Catholic hospitals. Not as much for the contraception piece of it as for the abortion and euthanasia piece. We have lots of activity going on, and euthanasia in particular right now. So we have said we need to change that. Right now in this volatile political climate, we're not going to be able to get close to getting a good dialogue on that, but we will, I think, after the election. We have new corporate structures in Catholic healthcare. We have a number of Catholic hospitals, and the most specific example is in Boston, where we have six Catholic hospitals that Cardinal O'Malley sold to a for-profit company, and he says they're still Catholic. Rome says they're still Catholic. He's put markers in for their Catholicity. But there are people that believe you can't be for-profit and not be Catholic. We have some systems right here in California, Dignity, which used to be CHW, that has part Catholic hospitals and part community hospitals. We have some other market-driven changes. We have Sisters of St. Joseph in Orange are working to put together with Hoag a system. Our relationship to the institutional church, I don't have to tell you about the situation in Phoenix. And so we have some real significant issues that we as church need to cope with, and to cope with in a prayerful and respectful way with each other for the future of Catholic health care. The life issues were a key piece of CHA. We said we would not vote for the bill. We would not support it if it contained federal funding of abortion. It does not contain federal funding of abortion. Two federal judges have ruled on that. One in Ohio and one in Virginia, explicitly saying there is no federal funding of abortion in the ACA. In the exchanges, you have to buy a separate plan if you want coverage for abortion. You have to pay for it all yourself. Other life issues that are every bit as important. In this bill, there is explicit language that says, if you are looking at me and I need a valve replacement, and you are looking at someone my same age who needs a valve replacement but happens to be developmentally disabled, you must make the decision on whether we get that valve replacement exactly the same way. You cannot say, excuse me, this one, you know, they're developmentally disabled. You know, who would want to live like that? Whenever I see people insert themselves into, he wouldn't want to live that way, I wouldn't want to live that way, I say, wait a minute. There's some people who say if they had false teeth, they wouldn't want to live. There's some people that say, I'd rather be dead than be a nun. There's some people that said, I'd rather be dead than married to him or her. So we shouldn't be making these judgments for each other. Get that. But this law is really explicit in protecting people whose lives could be undervalued and whose dignity could be undervalued. You can't require, the law explicitly says, you can't require any provider, individual or institutional, to provide euthanasia or abortion to be in the plan. We are concerned about the mandate and the definition of religious employer. We are working with the administration on this and with the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. I think until the election is over, it is entirely too volatile an environment. Right now, we're waiting on the final recommendations. We've said right now what the accommodation says is that we wouldn't have to buy, refer, or negotiate for coverage for employees, but they will get it separate if we are a Catholic university or hospital. We're working to improve that because we believe the mechanisms they're using are not the best, and the definition they're using is not the best definition. We think that they use the definition that California used and New York used, and they used it because it was litigated in California and New York, and the states won. We would rather they use a longer, more time-honored definition like one of the ones in the IRS code. We think that will happen. There are major drivers of change: reform, technology, scientific advances. We have to be a strong Catholic healthcare presence and a strong church to deal with these well. You know, technology, the communication technology, the medical technology, the research that's going on is all dramatically changing. I tell this to the CEOs. I know you're really worried about the Affordable Care Act, and you should be, but it's not anywhere near as big as the scientific advances that are on the horizon, and some of them are here. And we need to look at that, not only from what it means for us in the delivery of healthcare and the financing of healthcare, but for those of you who spend a lot of time looking at the ethics of it. I was with Dr. Francis Collins, who was looking at, he was showing his genome mapping, and he was talking about the fact that he had a 25% greater chance of becoming a type 2 diabetic than the average person in the population. That encouraged him to lose weight and to keep it off, and that was really important. But I looked at that genome. It said how much greater chance you had of having Alzheimer's, of being a sociopath. A lot of things, and you say, do you want to look at a genome in a kid when they're born and say, this determines them? Who has the right to that information? You know, those are serious issues. We have a lot of things. Stem cells have enormous potential. And I think, quite frankly, we're past the real worry about the embryonic. I think most people in science know that they don't have the potential the others do. But how to use them well and to make sure people who need them get them, not just people who can afford them. And so I say to you in closing, there are daunting challenges, but they pale in comparison to the ones our founders faced in a new country, a civil war, world wars, depression. The faith dimension of our ministry is its greatest strength. It always has been and it always will be. We have the potential today to have a country where the vast majority of people have health insurance, and our vision is healthcare that protects life from conception till natural death. Thank you very much, and I'm open to questions.
We've just heard from Sister Carol Keehan, the president of the Catholic Health Association of the United States. I'm Kirk Hansen, executive director of the Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara, and I'll be asking you the questions, Sister Carol. I'd like to start with two about Catholic healthcare in general. There are a couple of questions about what's different about a Catholic hospital from a for-profit hospital or a secular hospital that doesn't have a faith connection. What's different if one were to walk into a Catholic hospital?
Let's say what should be different. You know, we all aspire. You know, you sort of chart your course by the stars. You never quite reach them. what people tell us. I mean, I remember a nurse when I was the CEO of Providence who said to me, Sister Carol, I came to Providence for the money. I stayed for the mission. You see in Catholic healthcare not only the things I talked to you about in terms of sponsoring programs the community needs, you should see a great respect, not only for the patient, the patient's family, but for the staff. You should see an attentiveness to respect for the staff, just reimbursement, and sharing the mission with the staff, letting staff contribute to that mission. You should see a real concern for the most vulnerable among us, a concern that we not only do what we absolutely have to do, but that we reach out. I mean, I look at one of our older sisters at Providence ran our clothes room, and we had a very, in Washington, D.C., not the best section. We had a huge drug treatment program, alcohol treatment program. We had lots of frequent flyers in the emergency room, and they didn't come in well-dressed, and some of them had to stay, and some of them didn't come in dressed well enough to be discharged. This sister kept this magnificent clothes room, and she wouldn't mind clean, well-kept clothes, except for underwear. I always used to laugh. You'd see this 80-year-old sister limping around in Kmart when they were having a sale on jockey shorts. And, you know, I said, this is the city's largest purchaser of jockey shorts, because no person should have to use used underwear. But for the staff to see that, and the staff became partners with her. And so you see that. Thomson Reuters, I mean, that's on a small scale. Thomson Reuters, a major company in this country who measure quality, said very clearly, if you look at quality in different kinds of hospitals that are sponsored differently, you will find on average quality better in a Catholic hospital because Catholic hospitals believe it is part of their mission to address quality. You will also see, I think, an attention to the whole person, which is really an important thing, to the spiritual, not only to what does the frozen section say about that tissue we just removed from your breast, but, you know, how are you dealing with it? How are you dealing with it as a person? How are you dealing with it in relation to your spiritual life? So I would say you see a treatment of the whole person, a concern for the most vulnerable, and a respect for everybody.
There's another question about the role of Catholic healthcare. Is there a comparable situation in any other country in the world where 1/6 of the care is provided by the Catholic system? Or is this fairly unique, at least in the industrialized world?
You know, there are some, certainly if you look at the industrialized world, we're probably unique. And it's one reason why, and you couple that with the fact that in the industrialized world, we're the only country that doesn't provide health care for all. So it makes it very challenging at times when I'm talking in the Vatican at why it is so absolutely critical that we keep Catholic health care for an attention and a focus on the most vulnerable. Because they're like, well, anybody can go to hospital and get health care. No, they can't, not in the richest nation in the world. But in some of the countries, places like India will tell us what a huge percent of the care is given by the church and is not, Haiti will tell you that, and is not seen, but not the industrialized world. We are unique in that.
The question is raised, there are a number of questions, obviously, on the Affordable Care Act, but particularly, what would be the next iteration of a system if we move from not the best law, but to one that is better? What would be the one or two reforms you would like to add to the Affordable Care Act in its current form?
You know, I think you deal in, when you're passing bills, you deal with the powers that be, and some of them are what I would call legitimate powers, and some of them are sort of illegitimate. But anyway, I think we could do we could do healthcare much less expensively, much more comprehensively, still giving people great choices. But you know, you deal with the powers that be and the people that impact Congress, whether you're dealing with healthcare, energy, or whatever. And so what I would hope to see, and what I think would be easier, is just to give every person either Medicare, which now is the plan that can get you into more doctors quicker than any plan. You know, maybe in some communities it's a challenge, but for overall in this nation, people have more access to specialists with Medicare, or to just give everybody in this country the same choice of plans as we give the federal employees. That's an easy plan, you know, an easy set of plans to administer, and you know, to deal with the financing of it in a much different way.
There are obviously many questions about the fight over the Affordable Care Act, and one of them that summarizes it is, to what do you attribute the debate within Catholic circles about the Affordable Care Act and whether to support it or not? Why was there a disagreement? What is it in the politics of the church or the theology of the church that led to that struggle?
I would say some of it was misinformation, sadly, serious misinformation. I mean, how many people today still are told that it contains abortion? You've got two federal judges now who've said it doesn't contain abortion. Some of it was misinformation. Some of it was politics. And I think I don't want to judge people's motives, but as I listen to people, so many people, when I finish talking, will say, I had no idea it didn't contain abortion. I had no idea judges have already ruled on the fact that it doesn't contain abortion. And other folks, I would say there was a systematic effort to promote serious misinformation on a number of topics, not only abortion. I mean, how many of you heard about death panels? All of those things. When you get that much misinformation, it is incredibly difficult to change it, even in people that are extraordinarily intelligent.
Okay. Couple of other questions about the future and the remaining conflict over the definition of a religious entity. Do you expect that to be resolved after the election, or do you think that will be implemented in its current form?
I have reason to believe that our organization and other and our member organizations will not have to buy, negotiate, or refer for contraception and sterilization, except in places where the state law transcends that, like California, New York. It's actually 28 states, but many of them have exemptions. But I think the definition, I actually think if we can get past a lot of the polarization, that we can deal with the definition question a lot better. My goal is to get us past it and to get us using a different definition. This definition doesn't serve anybody well. It's not like there's a group on one side that's got, you know, whose ox will be gored if we change this definition. So my great hope is that we need to let the dust settle, I think.
There are a couple of questions about the state of debate amongst bishops. And
and you think I'm wading into that?
No. The question is not between CHA and the bishops, but between the bishops and the bishops.
Mm-hmm.
A question about why there isn't more diversity of opinion amongst bishops apparent in public statements.
My assessment of that is that, and this is my assessment, this is not, it's not ex cathedra. My assessment is that the bishops place a great deal of value on one voice and not having a diversity. opinions out there. You know, people can argue whether that's healthy or good or whatever, but that's the way I see it. It may not be why it's not out there.
A couple of questions back to the Affordable Care Act. There was criticism of the Affordable Care Act for not actually reducing the cost of health care in this country. Are you indeed optimistic, as one of your comments earlier said, that you felt there would be progress made? Does more progress need to be made in reining in cost?
I think there's a lot more progress to be made, but I think that's not an accurate statement. The actual changes that were made in the Affordable Care Act did a great deal to roll out the solvency of the Medicare program. We have this big fight right now of $700 billion taken out of Medicare. It's not taken out of the Medicare benefits. It's taken out of what I'm going to pay you for those benefits, and you'll keep on supplying them to hospitals, doctors, drug companies, extended care, all those people. So it rolled out the solvency in the Medicare program. It has reduced, you know, the insurance product will reduce it. What they did for with the pharmaceutical company to say, you will drop the cost and you will make drugs, generic drugs available, was a tremendous step forward in Part D. There are a number of other areas where the bill has really dropped down. And Medicare patients get either regular Medicare or Medicare managed care. And the government had clear evidence that Medicare managed care cost about 14% per person than regular Medicare. But you could not find more benefits or better outcomes and better quality in either. They were the same quality, the same outcomes. They said, we're not paying those insurance companies 14% more to do this. So they're dropping that down. 14% per person less for what it costs for a Medicare patient, for the millions of patients in Medicare that are insured in managed care, is a lot of money. And that's dropped down. And they said at first, oh, well, we won't insure them. We've got more people in Medicare managed care. They said, well, we won't give them as many benefits. They've got more benefits per person. So there's a lot in there. In addition, there are a lot of things in there that not much has been made of. There's some simplification with electronic medical records. There's a lot going on in Medicare fraud. We've had more significant action on Medicare fraud in the last 3 years than we've had in the last 10.
There's a question which really asks probing about the death panels issue, which is rationing is said to be the only ultimate solution to cost control in medicine, rationing particularly in the last year of life. Is that indeed going to be necessary?
This great nation does not need to ration care. You look at the things we spend money on in this nation, where there are a lot more areas we can ration before we start rationing care, okay? That's the first thing. Second thing, the least expensive care is the best care. Thirdly, in the death panel piece, I've taken care of a lot of people in my years in healthcare. I have yet to meet the first person who says, I want to die tied down in ICU with a ventilator and 3 IV lines and a Foley catheter in me. I don't know anybody that wants that. And oftentimes, because of legal issues, we have to keep doing things to patients who are dying instead of letting that patient die surrounded by their family in clean sheets, not tied down, not with tubes in their nose, tubes every other place you can have tubes, and, you know, ventilators, EKG, you know, the electronic monitors beeping and in an ICU. There is no reason why, but if we don't have more clear thinking, more reasonable discussion about what do you want when there's nothing more we can do for you. We on the hospital end are petrified not to keep doing what you need if we haven't been told we don't have to or that you don't want it. And part of that is us getting better at having the conversation. Part of it is families and people getting better. But that's not rationing your care. That's giving you the care that will help you. You know, if you have 2 weeks to live with cancer, do you want to live in an ICU with a tube down your throat and a tube in your stomach and a tube in your bladder and all these monitors hooked up to? No. Most people, if they have only 2 weeks to live, want to live gently and comfortably, want to be able to hold somebody's hand, want to be able to have the sacraments, and want to be in peace. And so if we give the best care to the seriously ill dying patient, either the elderly dying or the person who's dying younger from a terminal disease, if we give them the best care, it will be less expensive, but far more humane and far more respectful of their dignity.
Final question that we have time for, and I'm sorry we haven't gotten to all the questions, but you told us before your talk that you were born on Capitol Hill. And for a nun to be heavily involved in lobbying, heavily involved in public policy, seems a bit strange. Perhaps we should expect you to be in the hospital taking care of patients. Why is public policy an important part of your ministry?
How do you answer a guy that just said you're strange? I mean, I'm supposed to love him. What can you say? I have spent many, many years caring for patients in unwed mothers' homes, in the emergency room. And I know the suffering of people. You know, I ran a children's hospital. I have an undergraduate degree in nursing and a graduate degree in healthcare finance because I want people to be able to get the care they need, not the care they can afford. And quite frankly, as a daughter of charity, it is important that we not only care for the poor, but we give voice to the poor. And I don't want to perpetuate a system in this country where the poor come hat in hand to get care and we pat ourselves on the back because we opened a clinic for them. Their dignity is so great, they need to be able to come with a card just like I do when I need care. It is not, you know, it is a stopgap measure to be setting up clinics and outpatient facilities for the poor. If we really love the people in this country who are rich, poor, and those who may have money but have terrible diseases, we make it possible for them to get care in the same dignified way we would want to do that. And you can't do that sitting quietly. And so I have a window on the care. I understand care. I understand the financing of it. And if I don't use that voice for the poor, shame on me.
I hope you all have enjoyed this evening's program hosted by the Markulis Center for Applied Ethics and the Ignatian Center for Jesuit Education at Santa Clara University and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Sister Carol Keehan, President and CEO of the Catholic Health Association of the United States. And thank you who have joined us on radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.